Right, so we're going to open up. Now, what I just picked up were David and Graham were just dying to talk to each other. They were saying, yeah, we've got to take these questions, but we want to talk to each other as well. As a deference, really, to our speakers and all they've given us, I think we ought to allow them to have the first conversation. So, David, you were about to challenge Graham, I believe.
You're two psychologists together, you've got at least three different theories of psychology.
I have all sorts of instinctive reactions to neuroscientific explanations of human behaviour. I feel that the whole business of fMRIs and EEGs and so on is a bit like trying to work out how an engine operates by seeing which bits heat up during the process, because you're not actually inside it. And evolutionary explanations, they've now given these names of sociobiology. I always have, because when you listen to the arguments that are put forward as sociobiology, they're usually either economic arguments or just arguments about the way society needs to operate in order to operate. And then to grace them to say that you can find some analogies in monkeys always seems to me totally. I've never seen one monkey take another monkey to court because it's stolen something. So I just feel there are levels of psychological and social psychological activity. And actually, Graham and I come out of a very similar sort of social psychological background. The debate may be seem a bit involved, a bit technical. I think, for instance, the work that Graham characterized as being that consciousness is not necessary, or it doesn't actually influence what we do and the decisions we make. Actually, it goes back to one of the major founders of modern psychology, William James, who has this wonderful account of decision making and consciousness, saying that in order to make certain decisions, you have to be so involved in the decision that you're not aware that you're making it. And the example he gives, which is a brilliant one, is that when you decide to get up in the morning, there is a moment at which you're thinking about getting up, and then there's another moment when you're up, and you actually cannot consciously monitor the process of deciding to get up. So that aspect of the way our awareness works has always been around. And the sorts of studies that Graham was alluding to that suggest that somehow or other there are motor movements in process before you can pick up the brain activity that implies consciousness seem to me to be oversimplified to interpret them as saying that consciousness doesn't have any influence over decisions and actions, and that actually there's a lot more things going on, and particularly if you're talking of habitual activities and activities that are driven by ways of dealing with the world, then there are all sorts of things, if you like, below the level of awareness that are influencing those sorts of processes. So I think that we have to be very careful how we take that sort of material.
I completely agree with David. on this matter. The technicality of the physiological work, Chris will know more about it than I do. Is it Libet?
Yes,
he did the original work. And I remember Sean Spence, who unfortunately couldn't give the paper, but we got Chris instead, actually wrote a paper, I think, in 1996, in which he argued that conscious will has no effect on behaviour. That's why it would... And Libet actually himself, in his commentary, criticised Spence's view and said, well, if you look at the timeline, there still is time for consciousness to affect. And Sean's response was it was dualism, etc. And the other... Well, I remember another commentary said that, well, consciousness could still affect it. It just may take a long time before the part of the brain that initiates the consciousness can actually be measured. In other words, you look at this. So in other words, the whole set of arguments there. And it's hugely, hugely problematic. I suppose what I did at the end was a little self-indulgent. What I was trying to do is, it was literally doing my head in, thinking, well, if this really is the case, if Sean comes along and says this, what do we do with conscious will? Is there anything? What are we going to do with it? So I came up with that. for people who believe that. Personally, I think I've got conscious will and it affects my behaviour personally. But if you take a purely materialistic, deterministic view, you, as a scientist, you'll need some kind of, I know David wouldn't agree it's science, but you need some kind of explanation, therefore, to make sense of why we're interested in conscious will. Otherwise, what's the point? Why make any differentiation? It wouldn't, doesn't make any sense. So, kind of devil's advocate, really.
Yeah, yeah. And it effectively does. And Chris, what is the point? Do you?
Well, no, I mean, the reason I would bring it up is really for the lawyers to ponder about. There is no such thing. But no, I suppose I generally agree. An underlying theme in the talk is there are so many dissociations between our objective measures and what we think we're measuring. I mean, the trouble with the discussion now is actually we've become very, very loose in defining what we're talking about. I mean, it's voluntary control is what was being measured rather than consciousness, or conscious will. Right. Yes, you want to separate that out. I mean, certainly there are times I think that we're just rationalising what we've done, so it may be the case that we don't actually have voluntary. But for the most part, I'd say we don't have the measures to be able to confidently do it. The Libet experiments and those sorts of experiments are interesting demonstration experiments.
We have a question right in the centre here.
Hello. Mick Holloway, Chief Executive of the Stepping Stones Trust, which works with ex-offenders in rehabilitation. My interest in this subject is the problem that we have at the moment is the silo effect, which is that we pathologize behaviour, the lawyers punish and send people either to prison or community punishment and then step back. In prison, people are punished and then they come out and we are left with picking up the pieces. What I'd like to ask is that the panelists' view of whether we can do some joined up thinking here and think about rehabilitation right from the start so that courts are involved in thinking, where is this person going to end up after they've served their sentence? It doesn't happen now, and there are actually limitations of what the courts can order in terms of rehabilitation. They can commit somebody who's insane to an institution, but there's very little else they can suggest. What's your view about courts or the pre-sentence stage thinking about rehabilitation at that stage rather than at the end?
This, of course, is a question that has been asked as long as there's been crime. And one of the things that always surprises as well, almost amuses me, is how these questions keep on cropping up as if they're new questions. Even simple things like, I mean, generally speaking, I think the rule of thumb is about 60% of offenders reoffend. Recidivism rate is around about that. You find studies from the 1890s saying that about 60% of offenders reoffend. With all the changes in our criminal system and all our changes in society and social processes, so I feel that we're hooked into a system in which being a criminal is part of the whole social process. And sometimes I've thought something that I hope is very controversial, which is how many people would lose their jobs in society if there was no crime? It's almost like the people who work on those sewage heaps, sort of recycling material in developing countries, that there's so many people who feed off the processes of crime. It's so much an integrated part of our society that actually finding ways around it that really see people. I mean, the communist societies, particularly China, works in a totally different way. The people are outside of the social processes, and therefore, if they commit crimes, and therefore they are dealt with as pariahs, and very often they're shot. So it's a very primitive system, but it's an attitude. It's a totally different attitude to what a criminal is. And I think these are the issues that we're always struggling with. And I don't think there's any simple answers. It's about the way in which our whole society is put together.
I'm trying to get to the rehab bit. I certainly have a lot more experience with prisons in the last 2 or 3 years than I ever had, and that's dealing with individuals who are on remand because they have murdered or assaulted somebody. And actually doing investigative work in prisons is pretty darn difficult. I'm not going to do a guide of prisons, but there's certainly someone goes to where one actually feels the regime is going to be useful for those individuals, whereas some are completely oppressive. Don't go to HMP Exeter, as say, an example. Don't go to the Southwest, in fact, because women in the Southwest end up in Bristol, even if they're living in Cornwall. They have this situation where there's complete separation. I tend to be a little bit along the line of I just don't think prison's a good idea. A couple of different sort of components. You mentioned hospitals or that line. In fact, the way the system works at the moment is dreadful. If one gets acquittals, one ends up with individuals who should be treated, but there isn't enough mechanism out there to treat them. So, in fact, some over the last 10, 15 years are beginning to reappear and have reoffended because actually they've just dropped out of the system. I think the idea of packages is actually quite nice. Rather than a sentence, like you're incarcerated for X, it needs the follow-up. And I don't know whether somebody would do the economics on it and find it's cheaper to look after them in the community and make sure they're repaying the community rather than finding themselves trapped in prison.
Can I just sort of develop that? Because I've been involved in some human rights legal cases on behalf of prisoners who are suffering in British prisons. And one of the things that's become very clear to me, really, as you say, is that prison in certain cases, under the right conditions, can be a saviour for some individuals if it's handled right and put together. I did a whole series of studies of prison buildings and the experience of them over the years, and I went around one of the early Borstals where they had this tremendous class in bricklaying, very proud of all the sort of training that they did. And a few years later, I was involved in trying to get some building work done in my house when I lived in Guildford. I noticed that there was this one young man. I mean, we got these local individuals who the police knew a lot about, but there was this one young man who seemed to be keeping the whole family going. They were hauling the bricks and so on, but he was laying them. And I said to him, "Where did you learn to bricklay?" And he'd learned in this prison. And clearly he was keeping quite a number of his family out of criminal activity from the training he'd got. But then there are other individuals in Scotland, that one of the cases I worked on, where they are so disturbing of the system that they're kept in solitary confinement for weeks at a time. And because of the law that they can't be kept there for longer than 28 days, I think, without it being reviewed, they're moved from prison to prison, and they're kept so they can spend a year in solitary confinement, individuals who become ever more disturbed as they move through that system. But I went to one of the solitary confinement places who said, "This is an opportunity for us to have the individuals on their own and to work with them and to get to know them and to help them." But that was only one of half a dozen places I went to where they had what they call in Scotland the ghost train. As they move around these prisons, nobody's quite sure where they are. But only one of the places saw solitary confinement as a potential positive opportunity for these individuals. So, yeah, there are things around that can be effective if they're put together, as you say, with all sorts of issues and expectations, and part of it is what you do with people in prison. And the law now, the human rights legislation, is very good on that regard, but of course a lot of prisons still don't really respond to it.
I have an anecdote which isn't terribly, but it's I would say that they shouldn't be allowed to learn about psychology. And I certainly had one who was 15 years ago, had an assault, and he was always saying he's had another turn. And I was sort of asking generally, what's he doing in prison now? He said, "Oh, studying psychology."
Historically, modern prisons are relatively new.
historically. This idea of incarcerating huge numbers of people in large buildings is pretty new historically, a couple of hundred years. People didn't used to do that. You'd stick them in the stocks and throw things at them and shame them. But they'd be part of the community. It sounds like an old hat, doesn't it? But part of the community. And punishment is this. Well, that's right, yes. Yeah. And within part of the community, but these large... You know,
Do you know why they were started putting them in prison? It was a sociological concept. Yes. The idea was that you had to separate them from the other people they were mixing with because that was a sort of criminogenic society, and that you had to put them in separate cells with a Bible so that they could contemplate on their sins. And they actually had these very cleverly designed prisons so that no prisoner could see each other, but they could all see the chaplain. And to begin with, they even put some sort of toilet facilities in the cells until people came around to look at them and said, oh, it's terrible, these people are living in toilets. And so they took them out. Then they had slopping out, which is a totally degrading activity for the prisoners and the prison officers. And the thing certainly decayed around that.
And isn't there a sense that we ask the state to do our revenge and our retribution for us? That, you know, your talk about the stocks was we engaged the village, and now we ask the state to take on revenge.
I think it's a real locked away. I always feel lucky when I'm able to leave the prison. I mean, it's just once you leave everything behind,
well, yes,
completely. You carry on.
No, I was interrupting you, Chris. I'm shutting up.
No, it's just this business of being banged up. You're so separated from everything else. And that's right, it is society, just let's move them out of the way and forget about them.
Because they did the same thing with mental patients, didn't they? The asylums that were to begin with, were thought of as a tremendous way of getting people away from the evil of the city and giving them farming communities, because being back to nature was seen as being a very therapeutic sort of activity. And then they very quickly turned into places where families got rid of awkward relations.
The Vikings apparently used to insist that the victim was the person who should inflict the punishment.
Yeah.
Questions. Yeah. Sorry.
This question is a bit off topic now, but I did want to ask Chris a specific question. I once had to see a man charged with indecent assault on a boy, who was the neighbour, one of his neighbours, and he had befriended him. And one of his defences was that he was having a dream about having sex with a woman, and when he woke up, he was having sex with the boy. Now, he still had to explain what the boy was doing in his bed, and I don't think anybody believed him anyway, and there was other evidence against him. So I didn't take it at all seriously, but I wondered if the next time I should... Take it a bit more seriously.
Because of sexomnia now, sleep sex, there are actually quite a lot of these coming through. So I have there are various ways of trying to divide them up. I mean, very often a lot of these cases are people have found themselves together. But I do recall one that was quite odd. And this was a Scottish one. Started with the chap's mother dying and the... wake, or at least they started drinking about midday. About three the following morning, they decided that perhaps the daughter, 26-year-old, was too drunk to go home. So she went to sleep downstairs, husband and wife upstairs. Following morning, the daughter wakes up between the two, leaves, and realizes that somebody's had sex with her, and it was the father. So in the report, now the wife reports that he would have sex with her while he was asleep. So, and if you followed that through, he's a sleepwalker, there is sexomnia. So I remember putting in the report that it's an unusual case because on the one hand, the daughter had to sleepwalk upstairs, find herself between the two, and then one had a second instance of something going on. But I wouldn't dismiss it. We deal with it as if it's a sleepwalking case. and use all the criteria that one normally does. So it probably the only, well, the big difference with the cases that are coming through is seeking the victim. There are rapes where the defence becomes, did it in my sleep? But it's a very, that's an unusual situation. I mean, you were saying how the boy actually found himself. If there was a reasonable explanation for that to have happened, and if there's evidence that the chap is a sleepwalker, and if there's evidence that he's had sex with other people, and they'll say, yeah, actually, he does it in his sleep, then that becomes a defence.
This is a question probably for Graham, slightly facetious, but not entirely. You gave us a lovely account of the perhaps spectrum between persuasion and hypnosis as far as it applies to the accused. To what extent is an effective barrister hypnotising his jury?
To me, from my point of view, hypnosis is in itself a suggestion. So the way I would describe it is if you take a standard hypnotic susceptibility scale, they've usually got about 12 suggestions. If you don't have hypnosis on them, there are 12 suggestions. If you had a hypnotic induction, there are 13 suggestions. There's the 12 suggestions and the original one, the hypnosis suggestion, the suggestion to somebody that they are hypnotized. From that point of view, the barrister is not hypnotizing people. He's persuading them, but hypnosis is more than just persuasion. It's not social persuasion. There's a whole literature on persuasion, and that would be my way of categorizing it. Otherwise, I think conceptually it gets mixed up. Hypnosis just becomes persuasion, and I don't think it is persuasion. I think it may involve persuasion, but it's the context of hypnosis which makes it special.
Can I confuse it a little further? Because you mentioned one of my favourite social psychologists, Orne, who developed the notion of demand characteristics, which is the idea that the situation, the context, carries with it all sorts of implications of how you're expected to behave. And it's a very powerful influence, and he's been involved in cases where, I mean, that's part of his challenge to the whole experimental study of hypnosis, is that that all you're doing is setting up these expectations. And it seems to me that is something that, in relation to the barristers and so on, that's something that a lot of people, particularly when they're in a sort of public position, actually use. And the whole issue of by exuding confidence and fluency and by using a particular style and way of dealing with things, you are implicitly indicating that you are right and it is part of the process of persuasion. And it seems to me, I mean, if you just take back from the notion that somebody's saying they're hypnotizing you, in fact, in many cases, that would have the opposite reaction, wouldn't it? People would say, well, okay, that you're not going to have any influence. But if you don't do that, then you can actually draw on a lot of what hypnotists do, which the main thing they do, it seems to me, is they've got to be supremely confident about the induction process. They've got to be very, very clear that they are in control and they are making these suggestions. And it seems to me that's something that overlaps with the use of the whole paraphernalia of many situations.
And isn't that the paraphernalia, the cloak, the wig? I mean, it's so mesmeric. Well,
Mesmer made a fortune out of it,
exactly.
Didn't he?
Yeah. It's very, Martin Orne, very interesting, as was a psychologist and a psychiatrist. And he was, as David said, he came up with these demand characteristics, and he came up with all sorts of wonderful experiments that showed the limitations of hypnotic phenomena and what people would do who weren't hypnotized. But until the day he died, he always believed there was a hypnotic state. He still thought there was something else as well, that he actually saw his role of getting rid of, let's get rid of those and see if there's anything left. Right. And he always thought there was something left.
Jane Boissier, I work for the Ministry of Defence, but it's got nothing to do with the question I'm about to ask Professor Wagstaff. I heard him present his research about the frontal lobes and I don't know how many years ago, and it's a question I wanted to ask then, and I have the opportunity now. Basically, I just want to put an alternative theory to the research, coming from a slightly different angle from somebody who's practiced hypnosis with various clients. And I see a huge distinction between the highly hypnotizable and the low hypnotizables. I'm a low hypnotizable, and I think I'd do very badly on his testing. I have a theory, just a theory, a suggestion maybe, that the high hypnotizables are, there is a huge barrier between the conscious and the unconscious. When you hypnotize them, they go to a completely different place and will be completely amnesic for any discussion you've had with them. The low hypnotizables, like myself, seem to almost have their conscious and their unconscious more in touch with each other on a regular basis. It's almost as if we are distracted by our unconscious, whereas the high hypnotizables aren't distracted at all. They're completely, as it were, conscious. Their unconscious is so well hidden, so out of the way, that it's not a distraction to them. An idea.
So the idea is that the high hypnotizables are extremely conscious.
That's right. They are totally conscious.
You said they had amnesia.
Sorry? When you hypnotize them and you do work with them, because when you hypnotize somebody, you have a conversation with them. You, in effect, have a conversation with their unconscious. And so people who are low hypnotizables, you have that discussion and their conscious mind is fully aware of what's happened during the consultation. You discuss it afterwards. We all have a conscious and an unconscious, but the high hypnotizables, you put them into a state of hypnosis, call it what you will, and you really have to look after them because they disappear somewhere else. They go somewhere else. And when you then talk to them consciously, when they come back to the here and now, they have no recollection for the conversation you've had with that unconscious part of them. So it's almost as if there is a huge barrier between the conscious and the unconscious with the high hypnotizables and with the rest of us mere mortals. I have a constant, in other words, my conscious and my unconscious are much more closely communicating with each other on a regular basis, whereas they seem to be not communicating with themselves, if that makes sense.
Very interesting. Is it interesting that the people you've worked with should have spontaneous amnesia? Because that's incredibly rare. I mean, most people you'd want them to remember what happened when they were hypnotized. I mean, it's very, very important. But high hypnotizable, I say the evidence suggests that people are very, very highly hypnotizable. And for example, have you ever suggested to them that they'll remember? Because that works extremely well. If you have someone has a, what tends to happen in terms of expectancies is if the person has a preconception that you're supposed to have spontaneous amnesia, that will tend to happen. That's why many therapists will actually say to people, and you will remember, just in case they have an expectancy that they're supposed to forget, because then they won't think about it. The issue was not that the hypnosis did have an effect on phonemic fluency. And I completely accept your point that there are some people. I mean, if you want to immerse yourself in hypnosis, meditation, relaxation, to the extent that you want to turn off external stimulation, some people are certainly capable of doing that. And of course, anybody in that condition is not going to respond. You take a person meditating. Once they put themselves in that condition, so you're almost asleep, it's very, very difficult to respond. But what's interesting about people in that condition is they won't respond to classic hypnotic suggestions. There's a whole issue surrounding this. They actually technically cease to be hypnotically suggestible. In other words, they've switched themselves off so much they're not actually doing anything. Sure. Which is interesting. Yes. Certainly some people are capable of doing that, yes.
I mean, just two questions that are coming out of this. One is the relationship between hypnosis and sleep. I suspect they're completely different phenomena. And to, what was the other one? The typical kind of movie of hypnosis is exploring memories. Yeah, and we've talked more about actions rather than memories. Yes, I mean, I'm not familiar with hypnosis at all, so, you know.
The early work, before Chris's type of work, was they just looked at EEGs, and the EEG of a highly hypnotizable person, hypnotized, didn't look like someone sleeping or sleepwalking.
It was drowsiness.
Yes, that's right, yes, yeah, yeah. And the brain work, the imaging work that Chris talked about was particularly interesting, because those areas, you don't get that selection of areas with hypnosis. No. And I that was the first time I'd heard that. That's really interesting. Yeah, yeah. So, no, it's not. And also, in sleep, some people have argued there's a connection with sleep disturbances and hypnotizability, and there isn't. There's the Iowa sleep disturbance scale. That doesn't seem to correlate. So it's not really related, no. Having said that, some people do go to sleep.
Hypnosis as being a way of exploring past memories which you forget in your conscious state. What do you think about that?
Yeah, well, no, the difficulty with that is that you're a hypnotist with skill will explore that in a particular way. So, for example, we've demonstrated ourselves that a relaxed state, meditational state, actually does facilitate memory. If you add to that the standard revivification context reinstatement, you do actually have the basis of a technique for exploring memory. The problem is you get these expectancies associated with it, and therapists who don't know what they're doing, who then start suggesting things to people, and out come the false memories, and we have all these sorts of problems. Yeah, yeah.
Thank you.
Yep.
Eric Abrams, my lead in to my question is actually thanks to the panel, because you mentioned mesmer. A few things strike me about mesmer. In his own time, he was criminalized. Separate of that, my memory of what the phenomenon of mesmerism led to seemed to have had a completely different series of social phenomena. You know, you had people grouping themselves together, going out into woods, hugging trees and all the rest, you know, predating the hippie generation by about 300 years. That seems to me to be something different to the way hypnosis is, that seems to be different to the social context that hypnosis has now. So is there something about we're already pre-hypnotized in our expectancy of what hypnosis will do for us? A separate issue is if you then say, for example, mesmerism was, it fell apart because of different aspects of contamination, then what is the contamination that we have in hypnosis in our current age? And the other thing that I was, when I was listening to your talk, another aspect of the hypnotic state was there seemed to be a lot that seemed to be akin to placebo in what you were saying in terms of suggestion. And I'm interested insofar as a comment from a psychotherapist recently, quite an influential one in the States, was that actually psychotherapy itself is the placebo effect. So I wonder what your thoughts are around that kind of stuff. I'm a bit woolly in my question. It wasn't a question, so I was a bit woolly.
Let's just dissect the first part. Yeah. Mesmer's whole practice was based on a theory of animal magnetism, so they go and hug the trees because the trees were magnetized, etc. Why that, people argue, that developed into what we call hypnosis was because at some stage that's the influence of suggestion became associated with sleep, with a neurological change. Some people due to James Braid, and other people say it happened earlier than that. But what linked them together was suggestion. Basically, the animal magnetism was suggestion. So that's why I say that people say that's the roots of hypnosis. There's some comment I was going to. What was the very last thing? The last point you made was about. Oh, the placebo. Yes, placebo is suggestion. It's the ultimate suggestion. To say the whole of psychotherapy is a placebo is probably That's what Eysenck said about psychoanalysis, I know, but whether the whole of cognitive behavioural therapy is a placebo, I don't know as I'd go that far. But certainly if hypnosis adds a placebo, all power to it.
It seems to me, though, the term placebo is a term that is used when you can't explain what's going on. Because I did a lot of work on alternative medicine, and it was impossible to disentangle what was suggestion, what was people going around, half a dozen different therapists who were doing all sorts of different things, and what was it related to relaxation and all sorts of different issues. And just to sort of dismiss that in a way as placebo is missing the point. But I would also like to suggest that our notions of hypnosis, like in so many areas, it hooks into the narratives we have of how this all works, and that in Mesmer's day, magnetism was the exciting new development, and that was part of the culture of the time, and that was used to try and develop these mechanisms of influence and persuasion. I seem to remember in the 30s, it was Quay, wasn't it? Quayism. Every day, in every way, I'm getting better and better. Autosuggestion was a great movement that was part, somehow or other, hooked into the 20s and 30s and what was going on. And I think our notions of hypnosis, clearly the problem a hypnotist has with a new patient is everything that people have read about hypnosis and all the films they've seen and everything, all those stories in which it features. And so the people are drawing on these sorts of things all the time, and they plug into often analogies with the technology of the day.
Remember, Charcot used to have these stages of hypnosis, one of which was catalepsy. Well, you don't get catalepsy these days. Well, not very many people do. It's a suggested stage, because that's what he thought would happen.
Now they will.
Yes.
Chris Allen, I'm a clinical hypnotherapist. I've experienced trance, deep trance, on many occasions. A question for Professor Wagstaff. About 13 years ago, I was at a training convention with Paul McKenna, and he invited people up on stage. I just happened to have a very good view. I was in some balcony looking over the stage hypnosis. He selected about half a dozen people, and many of them, the induction seemed to be remarkably fast, and I thought, rather suspicious in that sense. You talked about tapping people, handshake sort of inductions, things of this type. But nonetheless, these people, about half a dozen, appeared to do some remarkably strange things and seemed to act as if they were automatons. Now, from my own experience, I agree with all of your comments this afternoon, but on the other, I'm trying to understand why it is that some stage hypnotists seem to be able to invoke this state of automatism. Could you give some kind of guidance on it?
When Barber did his original account of stage hypnosis, and he noticed some of the volumes by the stage hypnotists, said that what you need to do is to establish behavioural compliance. What you're trying to do is get people just to do what they're told. It's a bit like the generation game or something. You get people to stand on the stage, you do foot in the door, you get them to comply with a small request, then you gradually increase the request. And I think that's a very interesting piece of the social interaction. It's social persuasion. It's a compliance effect. What happens sometimes is after that, people will say, I felt I wasn't in control. He was in control. But what they mean is, I felt I wasn't in control in the sense of compliance. In other words, I felt socially obliged to do this. And of course, for some people, they realize halfway through it they've made a mistake. Now, some people enjoy it. Some people enjoy stage hypnosis. Some people actually think, I'm standing up here now, I just don't want to do this anymore. And he's telling me I've got no breast or something like that. And I'm excruciatingly embarrassed. And some people find that quite upsetting. Yes. But I would say that certainly the early textbooks on stage hypnosis, it actually advised you to learn how to establish behavioural compliance, because they're not. It doesn't look like anything to do with relaxation or anything you'd use in therapy. I mean, it doesn't. Tapping you on the head and falling over backwards or something and then running around is not what you do in therapy, is it? It's compliance. It's like the generation game or something.
Actually, that's interesting. I mean, it reminds me of something totally different, but obviously the same process. Are these emails you get now that say you've won $200 million and you all you need to do is to get in touch. And they're exactly the same thing, that a very small proportion of people will give a small amount of money to, you know, that what happens if you get in touch with them, they say, we just need £20 just to open a bank account, and you give the £20. And then they say, oh, actually, there's been a bit of a problem. We've got to bribe somebody. We need a couple of hundred. And then they will slowly lead people into it. And the average person who gets caught in this loses about £30,000. And indeed, there is some suggestion that there are a number of murders a year in places like Nigeria, which seems to export this, where people go there to try and get the money back and actually get killed. So, but it's exactly the same. We've studied these letters to learn about the psychology of persuasion, because there's an evolutionary process there, that what happens is that a certain sort of way of handling it is successful, and then they will develop that further. And of course, they send out now millions of these, and they only need a very small proportion of people to respond, just as in stage hypnosis. They only need a half a dozen people from an audience of a few hundred or a few thousand, and they've got an act. So it's really looking for those few individuals who possibly just want to be up on stage or have some problem that they want to have solved.
That's not uncommon. You occasionally get someone standing up on the stage because this is hypnosis, and I've heard hypnosis may be good for you, so let's give it a go to see if I want hypnotherapy. And then they could be quite traumatised by standing up on the stage and being put through that. But not because it's because of compliance they put themselves in that ridiculous situation.
Please, can we make the point? Stage hypnosis and hypnotherapy are quite different.
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely.
Right, it's me again, sorry. just on the last point, on the point you've been talking about, some stage hypnotists nowadays don't use hypnosis, and they can circumvent the local licensing laws that way. One famous one is Martin Turner, and he has, by all accounts, a terrific show and just as much automatism, apparently, as the conventional stage hypnotists. What I wanted to say a bit more about the Darwish case, if I may. Yes. This is the one that I was involved in. The case that Graham described was of a woman in 2001 who came forward with a complaint that Darwish was the father of her daughter. I think her daughter was 12 by that stage, but she'd always had in the back of her mind that Darwish was the father. Darwish was her gynecologist and obstetrician, who also practiced hypnosis. One day she opens her paper, newspaper, to read that Dr. Darwish is in court for a whole series of sexual offences against his patients going back 15 years. So then she comes forward and makes her complaint. And then there's a new trial with Darwish. And she explains to the barrister she always suspected this, and so they had DNA evidence, and sure enough, it was his daughter. But the court said, you can't say anything about that now, because the jury are not allowed to know that Dr. Darwish is now in prison for all these other offences. That was not allowed in court. So she was told to make up this story about her husband, who was a painter and decorator, I think, going to Darwish's house and suddenly being struck by the likeness of Darwish's daughter and his daughter. But it wasn't... it didn't happen quite the way, but the... But Darwish, by that stage, was in prison. So he was brought from the prison cells to the court, but the jury didn't know that. And there was a terrific furore afterwards by victim groups and saying, why wasn't the court not allowed to know this? He had, I think, 8 charges, found on 8 counts of indecent assault of his
patients. And as Graham described, most of the women described how they lay there thinking, he shouldn't be doing this, he shouldn't be doing this, but he's a doctor. He was using hypnosis, but the hypnosis had no role in this. They knew exactly everything that was going on and weren't sure what to do. And even some of those women after that went back for further appointments. They were willing to give him the benefit of the doubt. So the one question was, had he hypnotized them to return next time and given them a post-hypnotic suggestion, you must return them to next time. Anyway.
Thank you, Mike. We'll get you out of here, Mike. Last question.
Frances, I'm a psychotherapist, and I was actually going to make a comment rather than a question. I wanted to say a big, big thank you to every presenter and to say how much I enjoyed today's workshop. Whilst the different speakers and the titles were perhaps initially inviting to look at the differences, the outstanding thing for me and the connection that I make is with the idea of narratives is how we have heard, in fact, different stories that went around the same theme. So in a way, how much of a richer story we heard connected with a theme that obviously, in a way or another, interested all of us. It was so engaging, so interesting to hear all these accounts. In the work that we are doing, maybe we might have read a little research on this or a little article on that, but it's so delightful to hear these narratives that are so well informed on every aspect of it and so well presented. So thank you very, very much, both to the organisers and to the presenters today. It was a delightful day. Thank you.
Gabriella, that was what I was going to say. Would you like to? Yes, I think we're finishing now. I would like to, really, the only people who haven't been thanked are yourselves. Thank you so much for coming. Thank you for your questions. You've stimulated our speakers. We've had a great day, and it's in no small way down to you. So thank you very much.